May it please the Court, my name is Greg Smith, and I'm here representing appellant Danny Jones. Mr. Jones submits that his judgment should be vacated and his case remanded back to the district court so that his motion to withdraw his guilty plea can be considered further and so that a judicial recommendation to place him in the residential drug and alcohol treatment program can be sought. The first issue is the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, and if you will indulge me, I'm going to try something I've never tried before, and I'm going to ask you just for a little while not to be interrupted with questions, because I want to recite for you from start to finish all of my client's statements during the plea colloquy in this case so that you can see this scenario through his eyes and his mouth. This will take about 30 seconds. Here is everything my client said during his entire plea colloquy in this case. Yes, I do. 54. Up to the 10th grade. I'm okay. Yes, I have. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm all right. I'll make it. Nah, not today. I'm supposed to be taking my high blood pressure pills. Because I have to go to the bathroom so much, I wouldn't be standing here right now. Yes, I do. Yes, I do, Your Honor. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, I was. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes. No, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That is the sum total of everything my client said during his plea colloquy on the morning of January 6, 2009. Often with two other people standing beside him saying the same or similar answers immediately before or after him. The district court had told them, I'm just going to ask for answers boom, boom, boom from one of you at a time, and that's pretty much what happened here. Now, I'm not telling this court that giving short answers in a colloquy by itself always justifies the withdrawal of a guilty plea.
Is it not the case that almost all guilty pleas, the judge recites the factual proffer already made and signed by the defendant and asks whether it's correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you were right, we would have to abandon almost all guilty pleas.
I'm not arguing for an across-the-board rule. I think every case needs to be taken on its facts and viewed individually in this context. But in this context, neither is this the sort of bulletproof plea colloquy the government is trying to paint. Mr. Jones, along with his co-defendants, engaged in a day-of-trial guilty plea with a jury pool waiting. And the charge that my client ultimately entered his plea to was never even written out. The charge that he was pleading to was never written out.
Well, he signed a factual proffer in support of the guilty plea, which wrote out the charge and which he signed. And it says all the elements of the offense, including the ones he now disputes. He also was presented with the same in his pre-sentence report, which described the offense, including all the elements he now says that he doesn't agree to, and he signed the pre-sentence report.
When he signs the pre-sentence report, Your Honor, it's merely signing receipt of the pre-sentence
report. No, it says he had no objection to anything in the pre-sentence report, which set out all the terms. But there's a factual proffer in support of the guilty plea. Isn't that his signature at the end of it?
It is, Your Honor.
Doesn't it describe the essential elements of the offense of conspiracy to which he's charged and state the offense to which he's charged?
Your Honor, I can't dispute that.
And when he said later in withdrawing his plea that he never sold heroin, isn't that inconsistent with the factual proffer in which it is said that defendant worked with Rex Pelotti, Edward Farley, and others to sell heroin in Langston Terrace?
Your Honor, my client has went to the 10th grade, didn't necessarily finish the 10th
grade.
Lots
of people in the 10th grade can read. There's no suggestion that he can't read. At least I haven't heard a representation that he can't read.
Your Honor,
let's be clear about this. If he can't read, this is an issue. But he didn't. He told the judge that he could read, and you're not making a representation that he can't read.
I believe he said, "I'm all right. I'm okay."
That's right. That's right. That's
I'm
what
okay.
He said.
He didn't say yes. He said, "I'm okay."
If you have a claim that your client can't read and he did not understand anything, that's one thing. But there is no evidence to support that in this record.
Your Honor, I'm appointed on appeal. I can't.
No, I understand. So I'm saying all you can do is represent the record.
The record says instead of answering the question yes when asked if he could read, he said, "I'm okay." And I think that raises some ambiguities.
One of his answers was, at the beginning of the plea colloquy, also the judge is pretty careful. He He defines a conspiracy. He says it's hard to define. Then he goes ahead and defines it. There's more explanation. And then he says what the basic charge is, that you were working together with these other people. And then he says, do you understand that? And that's one of his yeses.
Your Honor, I think this has to be viewed through the context of my client being a 30-year addict and lacking of 10th grade education, not answering the question yes to whether he reads. Obviously, if you're going to credit fully without looking further the plea agreement and factual proffer that he signed, then there's nothing for me to say. But I think when you view it in the overall context, here's what we have. The charge is never written out. This is the count one of the superseding indictment said more than 1 kilogram of heroin, and he pled guilty to a lesser included charge. That new charge was never drafted. The closest is an indirect reference to it in the plea agreement.
It says defendant agrees to enter a plea of guilty to conspiracy to distribute and possess with the intent to distribute 100 grams of heroin.
It is in the written agreement. That's correct.
Right.
But the charge, you can't point to a charge and say, here is the new charge and here's what he pled to. But more importantly is the circumstance.
What else would the new charge say than that? You're talking about, is there a superseding indictment or something, you mean?
Right. I'm saying an information that he would plead to where it's set forth where he can point, you can point to it and say, here's the new charge.
Well, what else is different than that's what the charge. Where is the superseding indictment? Is it in the?
The superseding indictment is in the index, but it doesn't contain this, Your Honor. It doesn't say the 100 grams or more. It again has the more than one kilo, and more importantly, it's the confusion created during the colloquy. There's a reference to substantive transactions by my client, hand-to-hand transactions. It's defined in substantive terms at various points. Now, there are times when the court says it more clearly than others, but when you say something like, when you use confusing language like this, the conspiracy is a hard thing to define simply, and if you try to define it simply, you end up being too simple about it. I think that would confuse anybody.
Well, then he tried to explain it, though.
Right.
He did try to explain it, Your Honor.
Conspiracy is referred to in the proffer, which was signed, the agreement, which was signed, and then Judge Robertson did, as Judge Tatel pointed out, a thorough job of trying to make sure that conspiracy was flagged for the defendants.
And if he had stopped there, I think it would be fine. But then he goes on to talk about what you did is hand-to-hand transaction. He's describing it in substantive instead of conspiratorial terms. I think it created sufficient confusion, particularly when you look at the entirety of the circumstances. Immediately before the next hearing, he's withdrawing his plea, and he's consistent thereafter, and he's all along saying exactly the same thing, which is, I thought I'd pled to what was in the discovery package. And that's what his claim is. And I think, and more importantly, on the larger issue, the issue of his competency is never adequately examined by the court. Basically, what we have here is that the trial judge rejected the recommendation of his own expert, the court-appointed expert, Dr. Teagarden, said we should do an inpatient evaluation of this guy, and
well,
he didn't.
Look, do we have the facts that there's a reference to a fax that Teagarden, is that her name?
It was never placed in the record. My client was representing himself at the time and didn't insist
that
we put it in the record. It's not in the record.
Maybe there's another way to see this, as she got an instruction from the judge to go see your client. He refused to see her, so she said, well, he has to be placed inpatient because otherwise it can't be done. But nothing in what we have, given that we don't have the facts, indicates that her recommendation for inpatient is because she questioned his competence rather than that she was unable to evaluate him.
Well, I submit the case ought to be sent back so that can be cleared up then. There's no reason for this court to think that she routinely sends people to 3-month inpatient treatment simply because they refuse to talk to her. That would certainly be an unusual.
She refused to talk to her. It doesn't seem to be any basis for her to make a competency evaluation if he didn't talk to her.
Other than the surrounding circumstances in the background that she found in talking to Ms. Katkish and others. So there and. I want to I've used my time. I don't want to...
Can I ask you about the RDAP?
Yes.
So as I understand the Bureau of Prison rules, first, with respect to the statute, I'm a little confused about what we think the statute means. The statute that's at the back of the government's brief is Section 3621. So that's a statute about considering recommendations about the place of the prisoner's imprisonment and the type of facility. Is RDAP itself either a place or a type of facility, or it's a program within the institution?
It's a program. It's the 500-hour intensive drug treatment program.
The statute itself doesn't apply. Is that right?
My understanding is that RDAP is a regular. Well, I think the statute allows for up to a year off if you complete the RDAP program.
I understand that part, but it's the.
It's not a placement. It's a program.
Not, yeah.
I would note, however, that my client has currently been moved to a facility, and I apologize to the court on the Winton matter, but he is now at FCI Talladega, where there is not an RDAP program. There is at the prison camp in Talladega, but not at FCI Talladega.
The government's representation, he was at a, his original placement was to a place where there was one.
That's correct.
And the government's representation is he refused to participate.
That's not in the record, but that's their representation. Obviously, I'm making this argument because
yours isn't in the record either.
That's correct.
Yeah. But do you know whether it's correct that he refused to participate?
I don't know. I don't dispute the government's recommendation, but he still has 3 years left on his sentence, and this remains a possibility. And in any event, all the other co-defendants, I think all of them, but certainly most of them, every time it was recommended in the court below that somebody be placed in the RDAP program, Judge Robertson granted that request.
The request to recommend him.
The request that it be recommended, that there be a judicial recommendation of placement in the RDAP program.
So when I look at the Bureau of Prison rules on this, you get priority if you're recommended, but you also get priority if you have a drug problem. And there's no distinction between those two. And he clearly has a drug problem. So it's not clear to me why we think that it's more likely he will get into the program with a recommendation, given that the only basis the judge has to make the recommendation, I take it, is what was in the pre-sentence report, right?
Well, there were also admissions on the record by my client that he was a 30-year addict, so...
Yeah, but was that not also in the pre-sentence report? Didn't he tell them that?
I don't recall whether...
But there's nothing that the judge knows that the prison staff won't know.
Yes, Your Honor, but we cite to a source that says one of the three primary factors that your prisons looks at in evaluating whether someone should get in the program is whether there is a judicial recommendation.
Right, but I didn't
see... And that's a separate factor from whether someone has a drug problem. The judicial recommendation in and of itself is a significant factor in whether someone is allowed in the program.
I read the article, but it has no citations at all.
All right.
But that's all we have is that one article. Is that article right?
It is written by someone who is familiar with the system, but I guess he didn't source it further.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Stephanie Brunowitz on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, appellant knew that he was pleading guilty to conspiracy to distribute more than 100 grams of heroin.
Now, isn't it, as we pointed out when we were talking to Mr. Smith, I mean, the court in the plea colloquy did start out talking about conspiracy and defining it, but he ended it talking just about, quote, hand-to-hand heroin sales on the street. Defendant confirmed it. He talked about how he got it, what he did with the money. And then the court ends this way. He says, Mr. Jones, hand-to-hand drug deals in Langston Terrace, 60 months is your deal.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't he have thought from that that's what he was pleading to?
Prior to that, the court had walked him through.
Right. I started my question out by saying I understand that that's the way the court began, by talking about conspiracy, but he ended with this. And, you know, this is a man with only a 10th grade education, and the court ends by saying, you know, Mr. Jones, hand-to-hand drug deals in Langston Terrace, 60-month is your deal.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
That sounds, I mean, sounds reasonably be thought by him as to say, okay, that's the deal.
If that were the only thing that he had said, but it had followed.
That's all he said in his conclusion.
It was his conclusion when he was wrapping up the discussion of what their agreement was in terms of the sentence for the C1C plea. So he was shortening for appellant's understanding that the entire colloquy they had had about his distributing heroin in Langston Terrace, his receiving that heroin from one party and knowing that it came from Rex Pelote, his returning the money, he was shorthanding that as hand-to-hand deals in Langston Terrace, 60 months is your deal. But given the fact that he had already been asked numerous times, are you pleading guilty to conspiracy? Are you pleading guilty to 100 grams? It couldn't be taken as a completely new deal that he was talking about. It was simply a shorthanded version of what he had previously talked about. And the previous time when he had asked him about the hand-to-hand heroin deals, he had elaborated that with everything that followed from that, which was his participation in the heroin trafficking conspiracy. And as some of your colleagues have already noted, as yourself also noted, prior to walking into this plea colloquy, he had signed two separate documents, both the plea agreement and the factual proffer, that set forth that he was pleading guilty to conspiracy. And in fact, the factual proffer, the first page of the plea agreement has conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute and to distribute 100 grams or more of a mixture of substance containing a detectable amount of heroin. That is in bold on the first time that he signs it. And it is also contained on the first page of the factual proffer that he signed separately. Those are items that he signed before he even walked into the room and had this conversation. At no point during this conversation did he ever indicate any hesitation or doubt as to what he was pleading guilty to. In fact, at the very beginning of the plea colloquy, when the court was saying the defendants are all pleading guilty to the same charge of conspiracy to distribute, possessed with intent to distribute 100 grams or more of heroin, it was called to the court's attention that one of the defendants, Mr. Farley, was actually pleading guilty to a lesser amount. And so the court corrected himself and said, actually, it's not 100 grams, it's a detectable amount. The other two, referring to Mr. McRae and appellant, are 100 grams or more. At no time during this did appellant give any indication, wait, we're talking about 100 grams? I thought we were just talking about my one sale, my 10 zips. At no point during this entire plea colloquy, during all of the yes I do, yes I do, yes sirs that opposing counsel read, at no point did he say, no sir, this is not the charge that I believe that I was pleading guilty to. He said, yes I do, under oath, to numerous questions about whether or not he was engaged in a conspiracy in heroin trafficking in Langston Terrace in 2007 and 2008. And that is the most important factor that this court is to consider in reviewing the district court's denial of his motion to withdraw the guilty plea, is whether there were any defects in the plea colloquy. And in this case, there were none. He agreed that he was pleading guilty of his own free will, that he was doing so because he was guilty, and the court acted in reliance on those representations under oath, that appellant understood what he was pleading guilty to, that appellant had read and understood and agreed with everything that he had signed in the factual proffer and in the plea agreement. Appellant was not a novice to the criminal justice system. This was at least his fourth or fifth conviction for a drug crime, and the PSR indicates that some of his previous convictions were as a result of a guilty plea. There's no indication at the time of the guilty plea that he was not following what was happening in court, or as he later said, that he was not paying attention. And the court took pains to explain it to him in plain language that he could understand. And he admitted all of these facts under oath, and the only thing that was discussed on that day was conspiracy. His undercover, his deal to the undercover was not discussed that day. He could not have believed that he was pleading guilty to that because he was never asked about that during the plea colloquy. With regard to his claim of innocence, it's simply frivolous that he brings up at the last moment that he believes that he was possessing the drugs merely for personal use. After five hearings on this matter, he brings it up on the final day, and it's frivolous on its face. He claims that he had 10 zips because he was buying them in bulk while he was in the halfway house.
You want to say something about the argument about the court's failure to order a psychological evaluation?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that it was an abuse of discretion on this particular record to fail to order a hearing. The court had had ample opportunity to observe appellant. He was certainly, in the trial court's estimation, behaving perhaps obstinately and stubbornly, but that does not rise to the level of a mental disease or a defect that made it impossible for him to understand the proceedings. There was no indication in the PSR that he had any previous diagnosis, that he was on any type of medication. And during the plea colloquy itself, which is the operative moment in terms of determining whether or not he needed to be evaluated for competency in order to determine whether or not he was pleading voluntarily and knowingly, there was no indication on that day whatsoever that there were any reason to question his competency. And subsequent concerns that may have been raised by counsel, in the court's opinion, and the court was entitled to rely on its own observations, were based on his being difficult. But that is certainly not the same thing as having a mental disease. He was choosing not to cooperate with his attorneys, but he wasn't being prevented from cooperating with them by some type of mental defect. And throughout the plea proceeding, he evinced an ability to pay attention, to make fine distinctions. He was able to communicate with the court throughout these plea proceedings about his understanding of the events and his understanding about the outcome of the proceedings. And with regard to appellant's claim concerning the residential drug abuse program.
Isn't our usual practice on ineffective assistance claims raised for the first time on appeal to remand and have the district court consider them in the first instance?
Your Honor, I don't think that would be necessary in this particular case. One portion of the claim has already fallen away in terms of the facility in which he is located. I can represent to the court that counsel today made the representation that he is now placed in a location called FCI Talladega. If going to the exact same location that opposing counsel had cited in his opening brief that lists, that lists the locations where that program is available, FCI Talladega is one of those locations.
Okay, but there are legal issues about whether this kind of claim is even cognizable. There are factual issues about what was going on at the particular places, all of which seems to me unusual for us to try to resolve in the first instance.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is somewhat unusual. However, given the fact that this is a purely discretionary decision by the Bureau of Prisons.
Well, but it's influenced by the judicial recommendation.
And to the extent that it would be influenced by that.
That raises an interesting legal question about whether that actually is enough, I think.
I see my time is about to expire. If I could have a moment
just
to answer your question. To the extent that it is so highly discretionary, it is hard to imagine how it could possibly be prejudicial if there are five steps of discretionary decisions that would have to take place in order for this to have been caused by his counsel's failure to request it. Then the court would have to grant it. The Bureau of Prisons would have to determine whether or not it would follow it. Appellant himself would have to decide whether or not he wants to enter into the program because it is a voluntary program. He himself would then have to complete the program, and then the Board of Prisons.
So under your theory, failure to seek RDAP can never be ineffective assistance of counsel?
I'm not sure that we need to go there here.
Well, I think what you just said goes there.
I think it goes to whether or not it could be prejudicial in these particular circumstances, especially given the fact that on remand, the government would purely be offering evidence that he himself is the only person standing in the way. He's already received
right.
the recommendation.
And that's an easier way to resolve this than the trickier legal question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I just ask, guys, is it only, it's the Bureau of Prison regulation that's at issue, is that right? The statute doesn't seem to have anything to do with this. Except for the fact that if you get into RDAP, you get you're eligible for early release, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
The regulation, as far as I can tell, just says, I'm going to read it to you. The inmates will get primary consideration for course placement if the staff determine, and then it lists four any one of four things. One of which is a recommendation, and another one is or. There is evidence of a history of alcohol or other drug use. Does the Bureau have any statistics or does the government have any statistics indicating that there's a difference between those two? That is, if you have a history of alcohol or drug use, you get an additional, there's greater odds of getting into the program if you also have a judge's consideration than if you don't?
Your Honor, I can't speak about other cases. I do know that in this case, the Bureau of Prisons reviewed his case, determined that he had the necessary background, and therefore he was recommended. I also know that if he had been...
So the staff recommended him in this case?
Bureau of Prisons recommended him.
So, and if that's the case, then there couldn't be an ineffective assistance claim, I take it, because there'd be no difference between those two.
That's
correct.
That
is, he got what he's asking for.
That's correct.
And this is just a fact question. So I just wondered whether I take Judge Kavanaugh's point that if sometimes we do send things back, on the other hand, there seems a little point in sending it back if there's no dispute about this. I don't know whether this is resolvable by a letter from the government and a letter from the defendant as to whether there is a dispute. Anyway, the government is prepared to present a letter attesting to what you just said, I take it.
Yes, we would be.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want that letter?
I would like to see, if you would mind, if you could, I'm not sure it'll make a difference in the disposition one way or the other, but I think it would be helpful if you could submit a letter, and perhaps if defense counsel could submit a letter indicating after a discussion with counsel whether there's a dispute about this. Defense counsel has a chance to come up in a second and respond to that.
Yes.
Okay.
If that's okay. All, Your Honor. Yeah.
Thank you.
What do you think about that, Mr. Smith? Would there be any point? Would you agree that if the Bureau of Prisons actually put him in the program and he's the one who declined, that this ineffectiveness issue wouldn't be enough of a reason to send it back?
Your Honor, his release date is 2013.
Uh-huh.
The government has made representations he turned down this program. I never had a chance to talk to my client in advance of that decision if it was in fact made. I wouldn't have raised this issue and wouldn't be persisting in it if I didn't think there was not some reason to think that he would relent and take this program, particularly given the possibility he may not have understood it could save him up to a year of time in prison. That may not have been fully explained to him.
That's a different question. Now you're talking about this is somebody who's already in prison. This is no longer the question of ineffective assistance at the sentencing, which is the one you're raising. Can you help me through this? Your issue is ineffective assistance at the moment of sentencing, right?
Yes, and my concern is that the lack of judicial recommendation has led to him now, they claim he went into the program and turned it down, but he has now been sent to a facility, FCI Talladega, where there is not.
Well, leave aside that.
I don't think he would have gotten transferred there if he had an ongoing, if the Bureau of Prisons had persisted in saying he's eligible for RDAP.
I don't know about the persistence. The question is whether if he had a judge's recommendation.
Right.
So they're saying they had the staff recommendation and he declined.
Right.
You're saying that if he had a judge's recommendation, it would have made a difference even if he declined?
I'm saying that if he were to ask for it today, I don't know if he would still be eligible for it. They offered it to him, the government claims, once, and he turned it down without talking to me. I don't know if he asked for it today, if he would get it. And I think that if he asked for it today, the decision about whether to offer it to him would be influenced by whether there is a judicial recommendation. As you just cited, the regulation itself talks about whether there is a recommendation as one of the factors in whether to allow him into this program. And I see no downside to sending this back to have this issue presented. And if Mr. Jones, I mean, the government can make its arguments, I can make my arguments. It seems to me that's where it ought to be done in the first instance instead of this
court. Wasn't hearing what the argument would be, that's all.
The argument would be ineffectiveness in failing to raise it and the fact that the judicial recommendation could influence not only the first decision, but ongoing decisions by the Bureau of Prisons, including ones that if he were to request it today, whether he would be allowed in.
Is there some factual dispute whether he turned it down? You were hinting at that.
I don't know, Your Honor. I've not posed the question directly. I went to see my client early on in this case with the court's blessing, and I appreciate that. But at that time, the government had not indicated to me their view or belief that he had turned down the program. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a chance to speak to him then.
So the government will file a letter. You're free to respond to it, obviously.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you want to say anything about the plea or anything? We took up all your time on we took up all your time on the ineffective assistance. Do you want to say anything in rebuttal on any of the other issues?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. Just on the plea agreement, briefly, on the competency issue, it seems to me that's where this rises or falls. Unless there is no reasonable doubt about his competency, this court's law says you're supposed to hold a hearing. No competency hearing was held here. The government said it's an abuse of discretion, but in the Williams case, the court didn't say it was an abuse of discretion. There they said that where there is no hearing held, quote, with no competency determination before us, our review is not limited by the clearly erroneous standard, but is comprehensive. So I submit that when the issue is whether to grant a hearing, that is not a clearly erroneous standard. That is a de novo evaluation by the court. Finally, I know it's unusual to reverse decisions not to grant motions to withdraw. But the judge here made comments to Mr. Jones that are also unusual. Said, what's your problem? You and I need to have a little conversation. Where were you when we had this plea agreement? Were you asleep that day? I'm going to let you sit in the hole for 3 more months. You sort of screwed things up for yourself, Mr. Jones. You don't get more than 3 lawyers. Tell me about the Sixth Amendment, Mr. Jones. One more and you're done. If he keeps refusing counsel, he's done. His string is out. Called him obstinate. Alluded him to him as possibly being, quote, pig-headed. First, you're going to listen to me. These were unusual comments.
What wasn't the premise of those comments that your client was getting a deal that was an incredibly good deal of 5 years, whereas if it had gone to trial, it was potentially a mandatory life sentence. And so all the judge's comments that you just read, I think, need to be taken in the broader context of your client was getting an extraordinary deal.
I think I've acknowledged as the comments and the surrounding circumstances in my brief. I've not tried to hide the ball at all. But at the end of the day, the decision is not his counsel's to make. It's not the court's to make. It's not mine to make in terms of the wisdom of it. Ultimately, and indeed, the Perez case the government cites, I think, stands for this. It's the client's call. And
it is,
hear what the client said.
You're asking, the question is sort of what the context of the judge's statements were here. And here, misremembering, the defendant had rejected 3 of the most experienced CJA lawyers we have, and each one trying to represent his best interests. So you could, if there is impatience indicated in the judge's discussion, which there clearly is, there's some background, some context for why there is impatience.
I don't disagree with that. I guess what I'm saying though is, what we ended up happening is the day of sentencing. The facts arrives on the judge's desk. He learns for the first time that his expert has recommended inpatient treatment, and his impatience at that point to proceed, I mean, it had devolved into basically a battle of wills between the judge and the defendant. And instead of saying, oh, gee, my expert recommends inpatient treatment, He made the decision to proceed, and I don't think that can be separated from the nature of the comments that he made. In retrospect, it should have been, when there was an issue raised about his competency, a hearing should have been held.
One thing I was a little confused about in a footnote, was he representing himself by the time of the sentencing?
He had, no. Through the denial of the withdrawal of the plea, he was not cooperating with counsel, and he was essentially speaking for himself during the arguments on the motion to withdraw the plea. At the sentencing, however, he was asked to consult with Mr. Silver, and he did, in fact, and Mr. Silver was the one who argued at sentencing. So sentencing was purely, as I understand it, done by counsel.
Okay. Mr. Smith, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Jones, and you've done a fine job, and we're grateful to you for your assistance.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.